Today's program was brought to you by VisitNapaValley.com, the official page for travel to the Napa Valley, America's legendary wine, food, arts, and wellness capital. For more information, visit www.visitnapavalley.com.
I'm Dave Arnold, host of Cooking Issues. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Welcome to Chef's Story. This is Dorothy Cann Hamilton, and today we're recording from the International Culinary Center. And my guest is, I have known a long time. He has been a New York fixture and more recently a Washington fixture as one of the great pastry chefs of our time. Bill Yosis has been the White House pastry chef. He has been feted by the Beard Foundation and probably all the award systems for the time that he was at Boulay. He is known among the industry experts as a very thoughtful, intellectual, intelligent, and delicious chef. And his scope goes so far beyond dessert or the last dish. So, Bill, welcome.
Thank you.
I'm very excited
that you're here today.
I'm
excited to be here, too. Great to sit down with you, Dorothy.
Okay. So where did you grow up, and when did you get your sweet tooth?
I grew up in Toledo, Ohio, a town known for glassmaking, not only plate glass, but also sort of the development of the glass industry, and a place that was sort of based around the automotive industry, and that's what almost everyone in that town did, my father included. And
was he a mechanic? Or?
No, he was an accountant for the what was then called the Libion's Ford Glass Company. It was part of this sort of huge glass-making apparatus that developed around cars from Corning, New York, and Buffalo, and then a lot of it moved to Ohio and the Ohio Valley when Detroit became the center of car making. A very thriving town, small town, maybe 500,000 people. My first memories of the house that I lived, that I grew up in, there was a sheep farm across the street. And now that I'm sort of an advocate for sustainability and, you know, and sort of linking to the land and farm to table, I look back on it fondly. But I was horrified at the time. And I was like, we're living, there's animals across the street.
Were you in the suburbs of Toledo?
The suburbs, you know, at that time. So this was in the late 50s. To really age myself. But, the suburbs grew rapidly. And so, unfortunately, there was this center of towns were disappearing and everybody's moving out and moving the farms away with them. So I was old enough, I think I was 5 or 6, to know that, you know, there were houses and cars and people and mom and dad, and they went to work. And then how could there be, you know, animals across the street? But now I look back at it and I think, my God, how lucky I was. That's truly that frontier between when city people had a direct connection with farmers. And we knew them and we, you know, and they were great. And I went to the daughter's birthday parties and, you know, I soon got over my sort of horror about this. We're moving into this the hinterlands, because the animals were cute, and the family was wonderful. We became good friends. But that interface between agriculture and city is something that has been really disappeared. And it's a tragic loss. And it's something that I think many of us in the food business are trying to regain, that so there's not such a barrier or such a distance. Mm.
So what were your first taste memories?
Well, I love desserts from the minute I was born, I'm sure. My mother was Irish, and my father was German and Polish background. So it was a fairly standard American kind of menu, but dinner was a very important thing in our house. It was, there was no question that you were going to be at dinner at a certain time, and that went through high school and even college. And so my mother was a very conscientious cook, not particularly creative, but she loved the magazines and the food magazines, and we'd always have new things. And several times a week we would have dessert, which I loved.
Only several times a week.
Oh, yeah. I mean, did people eat dessert every night anywhere, or did they then? I don't think so.
I'm trying to remember. Yeah,
It was a special occasion. And I mean, special could be, it's Wednesday and I wanted to try this new recipe. It's not like it had to be a birthday. But
was dinner one course or two?
It was family style, so no, there was never, my mother would not have made two courses.
Right.
There was not going to be any serving. Yeah. It was family style. There was plenty, and it was good and fresh. And my father had a garden in the background, which interested me not at all. And he had in the backyard, he grew all kinds of great vegetables and all that. But that's how we grew
up. You were basically an eater. Did you ever work in the kitchen with your mom?
Not till later. Yeah, there were times when, and baking, I was interested at times. But it really didn't, seep into me or make me excited until later in life. I was a bookish kid. I was a bookworm and a nerd, and I loved school. I loved studying. I just would bury myself in books. And I did that completely through college and graduate school. And it was only after graduate school, because I studied French, that I came into contact with the incredible culture of food in France. And that's when I rediscovered this whole sort of link between how food is grown, where it's grown, how that influences its taste, and then, like, how chefs deal.
So when did you first go to France?
The first time I went to France was in 1975. I had graduated from college. I was already a French major, and I went to France, to Avignon.
Was it a college?
No, it was not sponsored. It was myself. I just went.
By yourself?
By myself. Oh, yeah. Well, I was, 22 years old, 21.
And you spoke French.
French, yeah.
Okay. Mm-hmm. So what were you expecting from France, and what did you find?
I was expecting to go to the Louvre, to go to the to Baudelaire's grave, and to look up Guillaume Apollinaire's house and Cézanne's house in the south of France, which I did, all of those things. But I was totally captivated by the food. It was just, I had never seen food like that. I'd never seen produce like that, and never seen these, just incredible connection to food, where you can talk to anyone on the street, as I discovered later, about how to make a good eclair. And I'm not talking about pastry chefs. You can stop anybody and ask what their opinion is of how long you bake it, how you mix it, and they have an opinion that is the only right opinion in their mind.
Anyway, when you were in college and studying French, you did that at Rutgers, right? You have a master's in French literature, right?
Rutgers. Uh-huh.
Did they ever talk about the culture of food in France?
Nothing.
So you weren't prepared to really go over there and be wow.
No. The reason, but when I wasn't,
it's
fascinating because it's totally different now. So when I, the way I was contacted, the way the food I came in contact with at the time was fellow students. They were French nationals who were studying French in America. I'm not quite sure why, but I think they didn't want to learn the language, but they wanted to learn about the literature. And they would host.
You know, Jacques Pepin has a master's in French literature from Columbia.
Yes, I know.
It's
I have been studying Jacques recently because of this upcoming tribute.
Birthday. Yeah. So
we would have dinner parties, and I would bring my turkey tetrazzini or whatever, and they would make duck à l'orange or something like that. That's when I first started to get the hint that there was really something going on here. But Yeah, I think that's when I really came to this incredible realization, and it just opened up my nose and my taste buds and my ears and my eyes.
So what did you – how long did you stay there? Did you work in a restaurant or how did –
The first time I went, it was just a short trip. It was after college. It was about a month, and I had a friend who was living there and visited her in Sète in the south of France, a beautiful little town. Still kind of unchanged. And I then went back to school, did graduate school, and then I would go back for longer periods. After I graduated from graduate school, I would that's when I decided to try out the food business. And so I took a job in Paris at a restaurant called La Foux, F-O-U-X, La Foux de Loz, which was Lyonnais-style cooking.
Oh.
Totally unknown to me. And it was tripe, tablier de sapeur, gras double, and everything homemade. And it was just such a revelation. But even more important than that is we used to go to the market at Rangis in the morning. And I often tell this story because Rangis still is. It's the best thing to do in Paris, bar none. God bless Notre Dame and the Louvre. But to go to Rangis in the morning and don't let your taxi leave you there because there's no way to get back. And to go through those halls of food, and anybody can go. They don't charge you to get in. You can go. You can't buy anything if you don't have a wholesaler's card. But that is a cathedral of beauty, you know, matching anything else in France. So we would go to all these different – there are pavillons, and you would go to Les Abats or to les fruits or les légumes or les fromages, and they're just airplane hangers big of the best food in Europe. And that's when I really realized this is going to be my job.
Whoa. So how did you act on that?
I went to cooking school, the best cooking school in Brooklyn, I always call it, New York City. It was called Community College at the time. Now it's called New York City Tech. School of
was Francis Lorenzini there?
Francis was there.
He was brilliant.
They had such, and I'm sure they still do have great faculty. In fact, I know many of the faculty there. They had a fantastic faculty. The pastry chef that was there with Mr. Lorenzini was had been the pastry chef at the Stork Club. Tom Ahrens had been was this kind of food maven who did the wine course, and he had sort of dated she was on the Today Show in the 50s. Arlene Francis. He used to bring all these celebrities to the parties. Hermione Gingold would come to our dinners, and he was just like so because he had been an entertainment lawyer, and then before he went to that school. So he was really connected to
this. So you had career changers back then.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, these were all he was definitely a career changer, maybe the first. But just this fascinating array of New York sort of hoi polloi and fascinating people. Then I was totally hooked. I mean, to sit next to Hermione Gingold at a restaurant, La Côte Basque, was just wonderful.
Wow. So where were your first jobs?
My first job was actually I went back to France and I did some stage, as we did then, a lot of Americans did, and I went to Le Toit de Passy, to Fauchon, La Maison de Chocolat, and I did some stage in all those places. And I would go back and forth to New York. The first place I worked at in New York, and I worked for free, as I always recommend young students to do, get the best place you can, it doesn't matter if you get paid or not, was called La Cascade, and it was owned by Guy Pascal, the great pastry chef, and they had great food there. It was in the Olympic Tower. And then after that, I went to eventually I got to Montrachet and with Drew Nieporn and David Boulay. It was in fairly early.
All right. Well, we're going to take a short break here, and we'll be right back because I think that's when you sort of catapult to fame.
Today's program was brought to you by VisitNapaValley.com. Welcome to the Napa Valley, North America's legendary wine and food capital, where the art of living well is defined, and each season holds a story waiting to be discovered. Life feels slower here, lived at a place where tables are set with care. Fine wine and food are created from the bounty of our own vineyards and gardens, and relationships with friends and family gathered around the table are somehow sweeter. When planning a trip to the Napa Valley, we invite you to visit the destination's official visitor website, visitnapavalley.com, or stop by Napa County's official visitor information center, located in downtown Napa, where our friendly and knowledgeable community ambassadors can assist you in creating your own legendary Napa Valley experiences. The Visitor Information Center is located at 600 Main Street in Napa and is open from 9 a.m. to 5 p.m., 7 days a week, 360 days a year. Your invitation to experience the Napa Valley beckons. Take a deep breath, lose yourself in our quiet green and golden hills, renew your body and spirit, taste our legendary wines and cuisine, and experience the people who make this valley like no other in the world. For more information, go to visitnapavalley.com.
Welcome back. You're listening to Chef's Story, and today my guest is Bill Yocis, the former White House pastry chef, and we're just learning he was also the chef at Boulle, the pastry chef at Boulle, in its heyday when it opened. So we're just about to venture there. So you actually started, so how did you meet David and you at Mon Roche? Who hired you? Was it David or was it Drew?
David. Yeah, that's it was so in that period when I was sort of after I had left school and I was going back and forth to France and wanted to work in food, I had taken a job with Air France. And I was working in the sales department at the airline and trying to figure out, well, how am I going to get in the food business? And so somebody there, a wonderful friend whose name is Avis de Gruel, and her husband worked at Le Périgord Park, a famous restaurant on Park Avenue. So her husband had a lot of friends in the food business, among them David Boulle. And David was around town, and so we both had asked to work with a very famous pastry chef who worked at Périgord Park at the time, whose name was Jean-Pierre Lemasson. And Jean-Pierre was this great, wonderful raconteur and pastry chef. And both David and I, so we both would work there on Saturdays as stagiaire again. And so that's how I met David. And then his girlfriend at the time then came to work at Air France, and we became close friends. And so, and my boyfriend at the time and David and his girlfriend, we used to hang out. And Danielle Ballou also was in this infamous group. And we used to go out to eat and have a grand old time. So I was not in the food business yet, but David helped me get into it at the other Périgord where he was started to work, Le Périgord on 52nd. Uh-huh. And I would go there on weekends and learn about cooking. And so, and then David moved to San Francisco to work with Hubert Keller on Sutter 500. I stayed in New York and went to France, started getting these like stages, went to school, and then it all came back together with Drew Nieport at Mon Roche in 1986, I guess it would have been.
How would you describe the scene to our young listeners out there, what the food scene was like in the early 80s in New York, downtown?
We thought we were something. We're here to change the world. And we did, but not in the way we didn't, but the world changed without us. So, yeah, it was a very exciting time. Le Bernardin was just starting, Mon Roche. Chanterelle was already going strong, and they were like a beacon of downtown fine dining. And David was making fantastic food, and I can still taste that seafood sausage.
David Waltuck.
So that was just a very exciting time, and the center of good food in New York had always been Midtown, from the Colony and the Pavillon, and that great tradition of French sort of influx into America. And so, but downtown there was a few. There was Odeon and Chanterelle in Soho, and so, and then Drew Nieporen, the visionary, really he is, a restaurateur, found this great space on West Broadway. And David and I, by that time, were working together at a place called Vienna Park, which was an Austrian restaurant.
It had 4 stars from the New York Times?
Vienna 79 on 79th Street had 4 stars. Wow. Vienna Park had 3. And it was great, really great food, and they had a wonderful pastry program. And I sort of started to work on the pastry program there for a short while. Then we opened Montrachet, and that was kind of – that was brand new because we did plated desserts. There hadn't been much plated desserts before that. It was a chariot or dessert cart. We used a lot of very modern techniques for the time. It could have been called maybe Nouvelle Cuisine, which sounds lightened cuisine. Yeah. And so this is right after sort of a big break in cooking in New York when Michael Romano was at Regine's, the nightclub, and they had great food that was also very modern sort of French three-star cooking. So that kind of had broken the mold, and we ran through the breach, so to speak, and we started doing this kind of cooking downtown where there was less cream, less butter. We were using vegetable stocks. We were using vegetable puree or fruit purees, in my case, to hold cakes together and hold – so we weren't using so much of the traditional French pastry techniques, and we were not the only ones. They were – Le Bernardin also Gilles had opened around the same time, right. And that was
but that was the new thinking in France,
very
you know,
so.
And
so,
it was very avant-garde.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So you know, we don't have all day, so we're going to have to fast forward because I think everyone's out there going to say, "How did you get to the White House?"
Leave the dinosaurs to the past. Yeah.
No. I mean, you were truly breaking new ground in New York in the 80s. That's a very important part of your career. And
well, we loved it. And Boulay Restaurant after that was sort of a more elaborate version of this, but it was still as creative and I think demanding in terms of a very sophisticated clientele and a very knowledgeable group who were coming to eat there, and they really knew what was going on, and they were reading, and this is of course pre-internet, but they were reading and they were going to France. And they knew what was going on, and they were very demanding in terms of, you have to show us new stuff. Mm-hmm. So that was – it was a very creative kitchen.
How many years were you there?
I worked there for 16 years. No, if I count Montrachet on through, it's about 16 years.
Wow.
If we count Vienna 79, it's about 16. But in any case That was also just a very creativity. I met so many people in the food business and also in the dining room. So I'll just tell you one anecdote quickly to sort of show the arc of history. So we used to, on Saturdays, open up the kitchen to people who wanted to come in and work with us, non-professionals. And there were lawyers and Wall Street guys and doctors and a lot of just people that weren't professionals that just loved cooking. But this one guy was the most serious of all. And his name was Tim Massett, and he came every week, and he just did whatever was asked of him, and he stayed the whole time, which could be 12 hours. And he just really loved cooking, and particularly pastry, so he spent a lot of time with me. And he developed – then he went to France, and he went to cooking school and all that. So when I finally took the job at the White House, it was – wonderful place to go, and every day going in those gates is just a rush of adrenaline and pride and just the greatest job I've ever had. And one day I was walking in, and Tim was there, ready to walk in with me. And I was like, oh, what are you doing here? He's like, well, I just took a job in Washington. I'm the director of – I should get the exact title right. We're very – touchy about our titles in Washington, but he was the director of TARP, so Toxic Assets Recovery Program.
Right.
Tim was now the person who reestablished the American economy after the crash of 2009.
Not Tim Geithner.
No, Tim. Tim Geithner was the Obama Treasury Secretary that Tim Massad worked for.
Oh, I see.
So he was the assistant to Tim Geithner. Tim Massad, who was this incredible baker stagiaire, and who... Mr. Geithner, Secretary Geithner, was the head of the whole Treasury, building next to the White House. Yeah. And Tim Massad was in charge of this very difficult restructuring of the American economy, highly criticized because, it's a bailout, where Main Street's paying for Wall Street. But
was the pressure greater in the Boulé kitchen?
We trained the TARP asset. And he
Talk
was, there was
about
nothing,
pressure.
Nothing bothered him after Boulé.
Yeah.
And just a shout out to Tim. He is now the chairman of the Commodities Federal Trade Commission.
Wow.
And so I always like to say, my pastry students have done very well. Not necessarily. And so, yes, he is that. And he's still a great baker, and he throws a party when he can. And his basement looks, I always say it looks like J.B. Prince. He's got like every utensil and beautifully arranged. And anyway, so that's just a fun kind of story about how, we started at this time when cooking was just so exciting, and it still is now. I feel now is like that time in the late 70s, early 80s, with so much interest and so much real quality cooking going on that is breaking molds everywhere, both in France and the United States, and Spain, of course, and in Scandinavia, as well as all over South America and Australia. It's just amazing. And it reminds me of that period of time. And if I was a young person today, I would do exactly the same thing. I would.
Isn't that a great thing?
It is.
So what drew you to the White House?
I was not drawn to the White House. They came to me, and I had no idea of... I mean, I was aware of the White House, of course, and I was aware of this incredible career of Roland Mesnier, who had been there for 25 years and retired. And when he retired, I think they were kind of thrown into a tizzy because they didn't know what to do. What are we going to do? This man has been like the, pillar of how we serve desserts at the White House for 25 years. So they started just picking up magazines, and who's this, who's that, food magazines. And so there was a picture of a dessert that I made in one of the magazines, and it might have been Food Arts. And so I got called and said, would you like to come and audition for this job? And I was flabbergasted, and at first I was not particularly interested. I was very happy doing what I was doing. But it kind of gnawed at me, and finally I did, and it was a great experience. And I actually, we don't have time for it here, but I'll refer you to, I tell a long story on the radio program The Moth. So The Moth on NPR has people come to tell stories about their lives and about, mm-hmm. Pivotal moments in their lives, emotional moments. Mm-hmm. And I tell that story in The Moth, so I'll refer you to that if you want to hear more about it.
All right, then you better give us a better story so The Moth doesn't have that over us.
Oh, no.
While you were in the White House.
Yeah. Well, that story is would be the day that the Obamas moved into the White House. So imagine this. I remember the election very well, and the night of the election. And the results were coming in. It wasn't until really midnight when the full results were in. And Pennsylvania Avenue in front of the White House and Lafayette Park was shoulder to shoulder. It was just the most wonderful American experience. And as it should be whenever there's a presidential election, there's no country that has the freedom, the transparency. And I know we have our problems with all the ways that we elect our officials, but we still have the most transparent and representative government on the planet. Mm. So that was a great moment. And living in Washington, I recommend it really to everyone, at least to visit. You really get the sense of how brilliant our founding fathers were and how this experiment in democracy is still working, and we should be very proud of it. So getting back to the story, so the Obamas move in. We start to have meetings, and it's a very – Clearly, it's an awkward moment because we've been working for the previous family, and, you know, development. There was genuine friendship and love because you're working there every day. You're cooking for this first family. And so there's then – but you might as well forget all that because you have a new boss. You have a new job entirely. And you better be ready to prove yourself too because it's not about you. So we had these meetings, and so I start to understand, you know, this, okay, this is their preferences. But then Monday, Mrs. Obama calls all the chefs into a meeting. And so it's a little bit awkward, like, oh, who's getting fired, you know? And but she starts out by saying that during the campaign that she noticed that she wasn't able to keep up with cooking for the family, and she, you know, wanted to have – healthier cooking. And she's told this story herself, so I'm not, like, talking out of school. But she said she wanted her girls to have, you know, better food. And she and her husband, too, she realized they weren't eating as well because they're always on the go. So they asked Sam Cass, who was a family friend, to come in and cook for them and to cook in healthy ways. And she then said to us, as chefs at the White House, she realized how important this was for her family and for all families, that there was – you know, this sort of deterioration of the family meal, of cooking, of eating in a healthy way. And she wanted her time at the White House to be devoted to improving that, and she was asking for our help. I had already been somewhat involved in sustainability and in sort of food education, food as medicine, so I was thrilled. I mean, that to me, that is the true moment. That's the story of my time at the White House. And you imagine this woman who, how many things could she have on her mind? Putting the kids in school, moving the furniture, you know, what color to paint the bedroom. Her husband has this new really difficult job. And yet she took the time, and we spent a good hour talking about this, and the rest of the next 3 months working on the garden, the garden on the south lawn that she sort of orchestrated and planted, that Sam Cass and myself and the other chefs worked on. It was a very thrilling time. It was just an amazing way for the First Lady to completely move a conversation into an area where chefs were considered someone that had something to say. You know, not that we didn't before, but...
No one asked.
Yes, right. And so... it was, you know, chefs were being then kind of slid into this almost policy sort of angle at the White House, which was amazing. And she totally changed the way people looked at the subject of sustainability, the subject of health. And she just totally changed the entire landscape. Because if you were doing it before, no matter who you were connected with, you were kind of considered a crackpot. And if you were talking about food in schools, you were like, oh, you know, oh, another organic tree hugger. That stopped in one day. That stopped immediately. And the whole subject became truly something that everyone wanted to discuss.
Okay, we're going to take another break. And when we come back, I want to hear what it's like to actually work in that house.
Yeah, sure.
Welcome back. You're listening to Chef Story. And today my guest is Bill Yoses, who was the former White House pastry chef. And we're going to hear right now what was your typical day like?
Well, the day starts at 7:30. There's a staff meeting. And that's a very interesting indication of what it's like to work there. Because the house has to remain very secure, and it's a very old house, to maintain the house... which is referred to as the executive residence, there are a number of teams who are permanently hired or semi-permanently. I mean, they stay throughout different administrations. There are plumbers, engineers, electricians, of course, florists, pastry chefs. It's a whole sort of team effort. And what's really cool about it is that everybody has place look as good as it can. So the maintenance of the house, it's been renovated several times. And the other part, for the part that's entertaining, which is really what that house was built for, the family, as you probably know, lives on the second floor. The first floor, I mean, I don't think, to this day, it doesn't have a bathroom. There's no bathroom on the first floor. It's like just entertain, and, you know, you've been a guest, we've wowed you, now leave.
I guess so, in the, when they built the house, they probably had outhouses, right?
They had outhouses.
Yeah, I never thought about that.
To this
that.
Day, there is still no, it always shocked me.
Is there still an outhouse?
There's no outhouse that I know of. No. But it's amazing. And so the first time you come into the house, and taking this job was not the first time, I had been there earlier on tours, you're just amazed at how beautiful a truly American style can be. And even though it was an Irish architect, James Hoban, and he was sort of basing it on Palladian images of symmetry, it's still a very American view. And George Washington, who was a surveyor, was involved in the design. Anyway, the reason I bring that up is that this whole team is devoted to making the house look good, making the first family look good, the president and first lady, especially when they're entertaining. So you have this very hardworking core group, and everybody supports everyone else. That's at the 7:30 meeting. We go over the day. These are the events. This is what's going to happen. And there could be three or four events a day. They're not always publicized. So you might have, we're getting ready for 150 people for breakfast. There's a small lunch for 12. The president has a head of state. And there's dinner for 150. Or 1,200, which can happen if there is a tent on the South Lawn, which is more and more the way entertaining heads of state takes place. So then you get through your day. If you're the pastry chef, you go back to the shop and you start to produce either for that day or for the upcoming events. That might include writing menus for upcoming events or simple menus that are proposals. So what's very different in the White House is that, you definitely are not the reason people are coming there. But you want still to be an important part of the whole experience. You want that when the guests come in, they're very excited to meet the president and first lady. And they're also very excited about their own group, whatever that is, whoever is being feted, whoever is being celebrated, or in many cases, it's not a celebration. It could be a military service where, heroes who have been lost in wars are being sort of honored. So it's not always a joyful experience. But through the food, through the decor, and through the entire demeanor of the house, you want people to feel that this moment is for them and them alone. The house doesn't change that much. I mean, there's...
So what about staffing? I mean, when the family is right there and you're doing, reasonable numbers, but when you have 1,500 coming for the lawn party, do you bring in freelancers?
Yes,
and what kind of vetting that do they have to go through?
They are freelancers. They're on contract. They come for a few days, or in the case of like the busy season, they may come for 2 months if it's around Christmas. And yes, they obviously have to go through security background checks.
Is that hard for you because you've got new groups of people coming in to work?
It's a facet of the job. The good thing is there's quite a few people that want to work at the White House. So you have a pretty good, group of candidates. But scheduling is really a very big part of the job. And there is a lot of scrutiny through a lot of oversight of budgets and planning and scheduling. And so there are many layers of that kind of work, which is part and parcel of the job.
So do you have to feed the public that comes to the White House as well as fulfill the personal needs of the family upstairs?
Yes. The short answer is yes. If your job is to serve the first family and their guests. So if they are invited guests. Now, there are tours in the daytime that go through the house. It is the only house of a head of state that 2,000 people a day walk through to see. That's why I say we are the most open government in the world, bar none. And there's not food provided for that. I mean, that's just the way people can see the house, and it's almost every day. You apply for that, by the way, before we started to get call-ins, you apply for that through your congressperson.
Oh, I see. Okay.
But that it can be done. So you prepare food for the first family and their guests. And that the guests are the part where it can be 10 in the morning, 200 in the afternoon, 5 at night.
Is there a little kitchen on the second floor where the girls can just go in and cook Duncan Hines mix?
I know this is public information, but we in the kitchen are very careful about saying anything about the second floor.
All right. Fair enough. No, I just wonder, because when you're a kid, you grow up in a kitchen. I think that's where your mom is, or you're always going to get something to eat.
Yes.
And I just could see, those two little girls, or big girls now, going downstairs, to see a professional kitchen. The president's on record as saying you make the best pie crust in the world.
I was very flattered.
Are you allowed to talk about the pies? Absolutely. Do you have a secret to your pie crust?
As soon as it's out there, I can talk about it. I do, and it's not secret anymore because I talk about it many times. I believe that there's no great pie crust without lard, and preferably leaf lard. I did we did with Christina Tozzi last year at the World Science Festival. We did a great demo on pies and pie making, where I talk about leaf lard. I was very flattered to hear him say it was at the LGBT event right towards the end of the time I was there, and it was I did not know that it was coming, and he started to talk about people that he had known in his life, and then he ended up saying, and my very talented pie making pastry chef. So it was a very moving moment. The pies are a big hit. He's on record as loving pie. And as he said that day, we soon saw that we were not going to be making pies every day. In fact, I can tell you the first words that President Obama said to me. We had this meeting in the East Room, a big room where all the staff was brought, and the president and first lady went around and introduced themselves. It was very interesting. Sort of anecdotes which we could talk about, but I'll tell you this one where Susie Morrison, who's the current executive pastry chef for the White House, and at the time we worked together in the pastry shop, somehow we were at the end of the line, and the president got there, and the first lady came first, and she had met us, and she said, these are the people who make the pies, because we had already served a few, and he just looked at us and said, stop. Just stop it. We are not going to have pies every day because I'm not going to look like Taft. So Taft, as was like 350-pound president. They had to change the bathtub in the White House when Taft was elected because he was too big.
Whoa.
But and it was clear that this was a joke and yet not really a joke. So he's pretty direct, he's a busy guy, so he's got to get the information across. And we didn't. So as he says often, we served it mostly on weekends or for special events and parties and holidays.
What's the thing you miss most about not working
there?
Well,
that adrenaline rush. I mean, that is it's part and parcel of the whole thing. You just go in and you really are primed to perform. The other thing I miss is the camaraderie of that team. And people often say to you, well, wasn't there a lot of pressure? And there is, but it's dispersed through this like 95-person team that, every day has to make sure that everything is just as it should be.
Is there a major domo for the White House that, coordinates everybody?
There is. So the most sort of famous one, and this is the tradition, this starts out from Washington and Jefferson's time. Jefferson had he had the James Hemings, who was a slave, and who was his chef, who he took to France to work in great French kitchens, and then came back and declined the job at the White House, actually, and sort of ended tragically. But his brother took the job. Fascinating story. So that whole tradition comes through all many years, and it sort of got passed off to, at one time, Dolly Madison was sort of the lady of the White House during those years. But the person who did it when I was there was an amazing man named George Haney. And he had started to work with President Johnson, who was a very colorful character, very just exuberant Texan, and sort of prone to last-minute requests and just loved to have a good time and loved to drink and loved to entertain and loved having people over. And so George was also an amazing raconteur. He just knew how to make the atmosphere in the house comfortable for people. He could spot right away if a person was uncomfortable, maybe just in being in that environment, he'd go up to them or have one of his, sort of acolytes go up to him and talk with them and make him feel comfortable, tell stories. He was from Alabama. He grew up in very poor surroundings. He could talk to anybody, kings, and he had kings, queens, princes, man on the street. Just a terrific guy.
That's the essence of hospitality, isn't it?
The essence of hospitality. He truly is. He's still around. He retired last year.
Someone should get him to write a book.
Oh, I'm dying to. I keep trying to urge him. Mm-hmm. But the book sort of a very, and I'll say this without any really rancor behind it, there was kind of a fictionalized version in the movie The Butler. Mm-hmm. And it was about a man named Gene Allen. The movie was a very Hollywood version of what Gene was about. And I had met Gene many times, and I worked with people that were his best friends and colleagues. And I think Gene would have been really upset by the movie. He considered it his ultimate duty to follow the discretion of not really talking about the first family, no matter what the conditions. And it was a very glamorized version. But it didn't need to be glamorized because the man himself was such an example of ethical, honest, genuine, it's an old-fashioned word, but rectitude. Like, just, I'm here to make these people's lives easier. And it was the kind of maitre d' that we, used to have in New York and still do in many places. Those people are truly American heroes.
There's this line in American hospitality of service where you don't want to feel like a servant. And there, some people just don't get it. They don't get it at all. And other people can embrace it and say, this is an honor to serve.
Right, right.
And I think it's very hard for people who don't understand one way or the other.
For Americans, it is. We're a very democratic, pluralistic society. We don't like hierarchy. But service is not about hierarchy. It's about giving yourself to something larger than yourself. It's about the antithesis of self-absorption. And a good example of that are these terrific people in the military who work in the White House and who work also in the West Wing where they cook for the staff. These guys, they give their life to something greater than themselves. And I think there's no better thing to do for
That's,
a chef
it's,
or a
truly
waiter.
Fulfilling. Yeah, there are a lot of people who in service. Okay, so now you've moved on from the White House,
yes.
And I know that you have. It's you're dedicating yourself to really something larger than all of us. Why don't you talk about that?
I would like to think so. So when people ask me what I do now, I say I teach kids to cook. So I'm the we call it the director of the cooking lab at Chop Chop Magazine, a fantastic magazine for kids and families about recipes that kids can do in the kitchen with their parents. And if the kids are old enough, they can do it by themselves. So we have a program in Boston where we go and we teach kids how to cook. Fantastic opportunity. We're sort of using it as a template to see what works with kids in the kitchen. And I can announce now that I'm going to be doing this class at ICC in a few weeks.
Oh, and we're so excited.
I'm very excited too. That is what I'm all about. And it's incredible how many people are recognizing that cooking and eating as a family is one of the single most important sort of what we call it, harbingers of success, not only for the children but for the parents. To sit down and have meals together is one of the single most greatest indicators of better class scores, but less disciplinary problems, and also that parents do better in their work too. So it's not just we're telling the kids how they should live. It's a great indicator of success. And so we're teaching kids. There are, I have many partners in this. There's a program at, this sort of stemmed out of the Harvard class called Science and Cooking, which was started with Ferran Adria and his, a whole bunch of us chefs from New York would go up there and we would do our recipes and the physics professors would talk about the physics of cooking. And that has sparked a lot of interest in other universities. UCLA has a program. Carleton College in Minnesota has an excellent program. It's run by a friend of mine whose name is Vayu Maini Rekdal. And he is his cooking club. Okay, he's a senior at Carleton. His cooking club has one-third of the student body enrolled.
Wow.
So, and I shouldn't say it's just the cooking club. It's the cooking science club. They get together. They make these meals. I've been there already to work with them. It's an amazing thing, and I hope it continues.
You're right. You know, we are on a new frontier, like absolutely. In the 70s and 80s, because it's an evolution. It's not just more of the same. You're working on a book, aren't you?
I am. I'm working on a book with the wonderful author Peter Kaminsky, and it is a pastry and baking book. And about what I learned in the last 8 years.
But you're one of the chefs who really do try to understand the science behind it.
I would like to think so. And all of us chefs, this is another thing that comes out of the 70s and 80s, where we wanted to understand the ingredients we worked with, whether you're pastry or savory. And so we wanted to see where it was grown, how it was grown, what are the genetics of the plant. What's the climate? What's the soil? The French would call it terroir. And we wanted to know why, you know, a grass-fed cow tastes differently from a grain-fed, or why this, you know, bok choy tastes better when it's grown in the soil. So I think many chefs are also taking that down to, like, a almost atomic level to understand what happens when you braise bok choy, when you sauté a piece of beef or fish to that protein. And that is sort of just looking more closely at your product. And it's the primacy of the ingredient, I think, that really fascinates chefs now and fascinates people who are, you know, non-professional chefs.
The primacy of the ingredient. We're back to the farm in Toledo, Ohio. Well, we've run out of time. I want to thank you so much. This has been fascinating.
Thank you for
And I can't wait to see the next chapter in your life. You've always done something so interesting, and I know you're going to make a huge contribution. And I am sure the president and the first family are lamenting not having your pies.
Well, I miss them too, but they have a great pastry chef there now, so I'm sure they're fine.
Okay. Well, thank you, and I want to thank Jack Innes and Robin Cohen, our producers, and we'll see you next time.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes Store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us with questions anytime at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a 501c3 nonprofit. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.